This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. Two significant stories for us to discuss today. Later, reaction to the record-breaking $12 million settlement being paid by the city of Louisville to the family of Breonna Taylor. But for now, we'll start on the south lawn of the White House, where hundreds gathered for a signing ceremony establishing diplomatic relations between Israel, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain. Israel's prime minister stressed why this was such an important moment.
Let us feel, on this day, the pulse of history. For long after the pandemic is gone, the peace we make today will endure. This week is Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, and what a blessing we bring to this new year. A blessing of friendship, a blessing of hope, a blessing of peace.
Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Trump are now eyeing further deals, including ones with Oman, Sudan, and Morocco. The agreement signed yesterday normalizes relations on everything from air travel to the establishment of embassies and security. But Israel's prime minister has some issues at home. Ahead of the Jewish New Year, the government is imposing a three-week lockdown to curb the spread of COVID-19. Let's talk more with Mark Regev, senior advisor to Benjamin Netanyahu. Mark, welcome to 1A.
Happy to be with you.
We're talking about three countries bound together with a shared antipathy toward Iran. Some people think President Trump is taking too much credit because there was a relationship there already. Do you think that's fair?
Ultimately, I remember when the peace team came into office, a lot of the so-called experts were very cynical. You know, the perceived wisdom was these people are not going to succeed, and yet they have, and they've gone beyond expectations. And we're hopeful that this momentum will continue, and we'll see other Arab and Muslim states move forward in their relations with Israel. It's good for the region, it's good for Israel, it's good for our neighbors, it's good for peace.
What difference do you see all this having on day-to-day life for Israelis and the prospects for greater stability in the Middle East?
Well, first of all, it's terribly, terribly important. Peace in itself is a worthy goal, and just signing peace treaties is a good thing. But ultimately, these, as you said in your introduction, we're talking about agreements for transportation, for the environment, for water, for cooperation in tourism, in a whole wealth of areas which will bring tangible benefits to the peoples of Israel and of the Gulf. And ultimately, it'll enhance prosperity, it'll enhance stability, it'll enhance security. This is a good thing. This is the Middle East becoming more normal. And I think that's something that everyone should support.
Well, to use your word, in making these relationships more normal, and if we do see this increase of economic integration between Israel and its neighbors, do you then see America playing less of a leading role in helping broker future peace deals?
No, I think the United States will remain a very special and active part of the peace process in the region. I think if we want to move forward, there'll be American involvement, and that's ultimately a very, very good thing. And I think it's also good for those people who want to see peace with the Palestinians. Because in the past, I think the conventional wisdom was that if Israel makes peace with the Palestinians, then the rest of the Arab world will open up to Israel. I think that goes back to the Arab peace initiative from the beginning of the century. But the truth is, maybe the opposite is happening. Maybe by increasing and strengthening our partnerships across the Arab world, we're creating a region where we will have the ability to move forward with the Palestinians. In other words, instead of it being Israel, Palestinians, Arab world, it will be Israel, Arab world, and the Palestinians will follow.
But we are hearing from some who think this signals that your government has given up on a peace deal. And what I'm hearing you say is that that's not the case. Is that accurate?
That's correct, 100%. We haven't given up. And we're ready on the basis of the American Peace Initiative to engage with the Palestinians immediately. It's they have who've so far closed the door. In many ways, they're imprisoned by their own rhetoric and their own historic rejectionism. I think when Arab countries, though, show that they believe in peace, that they believe in negotiation, that they believe in engagement in Israel, that ultimately has to affect Palestinian opinion, too, and in a positive way.
You said you are reaching out to the Palestinian government. What does that look like right now, functionally?
Well, the Palestinians obviously have slammed the door shut. I think they rejected the American initiative even before it was launched, to the annoyance of many of the Arab states, to be frank about it. But we haven't closed the door. If the Palestinians decide that they want to negotiate, we've got the American initiative. We're willing to discuss that. We're willing to move forward. It's not Israel that has closed this option.
So the push for a long-term two-state solution is still on the table for you.
Once again, we're willing for peace and reconciliation with the Palestinians, and we think the plan that was put on table on the table in January by the United States is the way forward, and we're willing to negotiate on the basis of that plan.
I want to turn to a crisis facing the globe right now, COVID-19. How different will the Jewish New Year be this year in Israel? As you know, people are not happy with the plan to introduce a new lockdown to help contain the virus.
We understand that. We didn't want to impose the lockdown as a government. We'd much prefer to allow everyone to continue their lives normally. But I'm afraid we haven't had a choice. We tried to do steps that were less intrusive. Less intrusive to people's lives, less intrusive to the economy. But unfortunately, we saw our numbers continue to go up. And in the end, the health people came to the government and said, listen, it's time now to take firmer steps. You'll recall earlier in the year, over the Passover holiday, we also had a lockdown, which people who were used to having their extended families over for the traditional Passover meal, the Seder, we couldn't do it. And it looks like that this Jewish New Year, this Rosh Hashanah, will be very, very similar, that we'll have a situation where the country will be substantively on lockdown, and we're going to ask people not to go to large gatherings, not to mix outside their immediate family units in order to try to contain the spread of the disease.
And what is the rate of COVID infection right now?
We're a small country. Israel is only 9 million people, and I think yesterday we had some 4,000 new reported cases. The good news in Israel is our death rate is very, very low. Our fatalities are low. Of course, every death in itself is a tragedy. But by global standards, we've managed to keep our death rate low. But we're worried about the growing infections, and we would be irresponsible if we didn't take more aggressive action.
Well, COVID in Israel is disproportionately impacting those in the Orthodox community. How challenging is the pushback from this part of society who traditionally take their cue from Scripture, not from the government?
The truth is, 3-4 weeks ago, the question would have been valid. But today, unfortunately, we've seen COVID spread well beyond the ultra-Orthodox community. It's not in one particular community. Unfortunately, today, it's in all communities. And it's incumbent upon us to do our best to safeguard the Israeli public from the spread of the disease. And unfortunately, yes, we didn't want to do it. But a lockdown is today necessary. And we'll be going for a lockout. And we'll only be looking and moving it again if we can see that the numbers of infection are going down. That's the main thing, to try to get the numbers down.
And what does enforcement of the lockdown look like?
We'll have the police on the streets. We'll have people who are supposed to be at home. If they're outside, the police have the ability to ask them questions. If someone's not wearing their mask in public, they can be fined. Obviously, though, it's based less on enforcement and more on the public doing the right thing. And I think people understand that if we continue as if nothing is happening, then it's not good for ourselves, it's not good for our families, it's not good for our neighbors. It's important that people stick by the rules. I can tell you, just for your own information, we're visiting now in Washington as part of this ceremony, but we're wearing our masks the whole time because we're under Israeli government guidelines. We're not going out. We're only staying indoors in the official residency where we are. We're at the hotel where we are. We're not going out at nights. We are in Washington fulfilling Israeli coronavirus measures because we are representatives of the government, and we have to be an example.
Well, here in the U.S., we have seen some tensions play out among certain religious communities who felt hampered by their state's regulations around COVID restrictions. And you know, they wanted to attend church in groups, and there was quite a bit of tension that rose around that here in the U.S. Are you seeing a similar dynamic play out in Israel?
Definitely. Obviously, the right of religious freedom is sacrosanct. It's central to the way we do things in Israel. But on the other hand, if people are going to pack into small houses of worship and spread the infection, that is not a good thing. So we've opted for dialogue with the different religious communities. Sometimes that's successful. Sometimes there's a more tense relationship depending on the community. But it's important to balance the need for religious freedom with the need to protect the public, and to find the right balance is sometimes, frankly, not easy. The same sort of tensions you've had in the United States, we've had in Israel, too.
In a recent interview for the BBC, you called yourself an optimist. After all the world has been through this year, what keeps you optimistic for your country and the prospects for a more peaceful future?
So I'm very optimistic about the future. I mean, it's true, in the middle of this pandemic, it's probably more natural to be less optimistic. But I remain an optimist, and I think the signing of a peace treaty, as I said, not with one, but with two Arab countries, something that's never happened before in the same event, is an amazing breakthrough. And I believe this is the wave of the future. This is the direction we're going. We're going to see more and more Arab countries reassess traditional attitudes of hostility towards of Israel, more and more them accepting Israel as legitimate part of the region. A historic reconciliation, which for Israelis is very, very exciting.
That's Mark Regev, senior advisor to Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Mark, thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Up next, The View from Jerusalem. We'll talk more about the deal that's just been signed and what might be to come. Plus, more on just how different the upcoming high holidays will be for millions in Israel and the political turmoil that's underway as a result of the new 3-week lockdown. We also want to hear from you. Your questions and comments are always welcome. You can comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or send us an email at 1A@WAMU.org. I'm Jen White, and this is 1A. I'm Jen White. Israel has become the first developed country in the world to impose a second nationwide lockdown due to COVID-19. The lockdown lasts until at least October 11th, stretching through the Jewish high holidays, Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, and Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the year and a day of atonement. It's a somber backdrop to a recent peace deal between Israel and the United Arab Emirates. For more on this, we're here with Daniel Estrin, NPR's national correspondent in Jerusalem. Daniel, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Benjamin Brown, professor of Jewish thought at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. He studies the varieties of Orthodox Judaism with an emphasis on ultra-Orthodox thought. Professor Brown, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Hi.
So, Daniel, before we go on, I'd like to get your response to what we just heard. Is there anything from our interview with the senior advisor that jumped out to you?
Well, he spoke about Israeli-Palestinian peace and how things are being flipped and that Israel is focusing on peace with regional Arab countries. You know, President Trump's original plan was the ultimate deal, as it's been called, Israeli-Palestinian peace. And that flopped. The Palestinians are not engaging with the U.S. They don't see Trump as an honest mediator. He has sided with Israel when it comes to so many of the thorny issues of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And Trump's peace plan, which Netanyahu's spokesman Mark Regev told you Israel wants to negotiate on, it's a non-starter for Palestinian leaders. It doesn't offer what they see as a viable independent state. So, yes, the U.S. and Israel have pivoted to focus on peace with Arab countries. The United Arab Emirates broke the ice. Bahrain came next. They're called peace agreements. I think it's fair to question the use of the word peace here. Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates never went to war with Israel. They've cooperated secretly for years. And after the White House ceremony yesterday, I spoke with several Israelis who said, yes, this is an accomplishment for Israel. Will it really affect my life personally? So yeah, it is a significant step. If we see commercial ties and flights and more acceptance for Israel in a unwelcoming region. But I think if there is a reminder of the real peace that Israel needs, it was yesterday. Palestinian militants fired rockets from Gaza toward Israel during the signing ceremony at the White House. Two Israelis were lightly wounded. So, like they say, you make peace with your enemies. So Palestinians cannot be ignored in this equation.
I want to read a couple of comments we got from listeners. Jim in Washington says, blaming the Palestinian for intransigence ignores the illegal settlements and the ideology behind them. And Brian emails, how are we to take seriously any peace plan in the Middle East that does not include the Palestinians? This smacks of politics as Trump and Kushner desperately need some kind of win coming into the U.S. election. I want to look at those two comments separately, Daniel, because we heard Regev there say that for Israel, a two-state solution is still on the table. But what is the path forward at this point?
Well, the path forward that the Trump administration and Israel are taking are, they're saying this is our peace plan now, not Israeli-Palestinian peace, but Israeli regional Arab peace. And they are hoping that first the United Arab Emirates, then Bahrain came. They're hoping other countries in the region provide a kind of momentum of dominoes falling. And they hope that the Palestinians see that and cave, and cave to the pressure of seeing their Arab allies siding with Israel. Palestinian officials I've been speaking with say we will not cave to pressure. They see this as, first of all, they believe that the Arab societies in the region support their cause, the Palestinian cause, and that this is a normalization deal between governments for government interests. The United Arab Emirates is, first of all, looking for to strengthen their position in the region. They saw an opportunity to curry favor with Trump. They would like to get fighter planes from the U.S. as a reward for their deal with Israel. So these deals with between Israel and these states are significant in a place, in a region where diplomacy moves so slowly. But the Palestinian-Israeli conflict remains.
And very briefly, apply the U.S. political lens on this as we head into the November election. How important is the timing of this agreement?
Oh, the timing could not be more important, right? I mean, yesterday Trump he was able to be seen as a peacemaker at the White House as he is facing an uphill reelection campaign, and all of the players played their role. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel has made no hint of the fact that he sees Trump as the best president ever for Israel and would like to see him reelected, although he doesn't say that openly. And the other countries as well, Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates, apparently want to boost Trump as well.
Well, let's pivot to the lockdown. Why did Israel go into lockdown again?
Well, Israel had a very stringent lockdown earlier this year. I mean, there were police checkpoints on Passover, preventing people from driving to relatives for Passover Seder night. And after that lockdown, infections did drop to about 20 a day. And then Israel quickly reopened. And I remember being in Tel Aviv, and it seemed like everyone had ripped off their masks. And Netanyahu said, "Israelis, go have fun, enjoy." And there was a lot of pressure on the government to open up the economy very quickly. So we saw event halls open up for wedding season. Life pretty much felt like it went back to normal. But those weddings were a big driving factor, driving up infections. And, you know, as Mark Regev, the Netanyahu spokesman, told you earlier, the death rate in Israel has been lower here than other countries. And there has been a low level of hospitalization. The death rates were not higher than usual. So Israel sort of lived with it, but that's not the case anymore. The infection rate has jumped to 4,000, even passing 5,000 daily cases here. And in the last month, Israelis have been dying at a higher than average rate. And the hospital said, you know, we are afraid of getting overwhelmed. So that is the idea behind this nationwide lockdown, starting on the eve of Rosh Hashanah, the new year, continuing through the entire Jewish holiday season. And I have to say, though, Jen, you know, there are so many holes built into this lockdown. I don't know how effective it's going to be. I mean, I've heard from Israelis saying, you know, we're going to continue our lives. We're going to have friends over, socially distanced, but we're going to make our own decisions. And if the police stops us, we'll say we're going to work, because that's an exception to the lockdown, if a lot of workplaces will be allowed to stay open.
Professor Brown, I want to bring you in because there's been ongoing tension between ultra-Orthodox communities and the Israeli government over this lockdown. Help us understand what's behind that tension.
Sorry?
I said there's been ongoing tension between ultra-Orthodox communities and this Israeli government over this lockdown. Can you help us understand what's behind that tension?
Yes. Basically, it's... by the way, may I just make a small comment regarding the previous item on the Israel Emirates treaty? Is that okay?
Please, yes, go ahead, briefly.
Okay, I just wanted to add that if we go to the root of the problem of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the point is, and that is something that is not heard enough, that the root of the problem is the fact that Israel, or the Jews, the pre-state Jewish agency, five times acknowledged the right of the Palestinians to their own state. The Palestinians have never, ever done so regarding to the Jewish state, a Jewish state, ever. And the reason for the non-negotiation of the last few years is the fact that Netanyahu demanded that the Palestinians acknowledge the right of the Jewish people to its own state. It never happened. Now, the importance of such a treaty is the fact, why? Because basically the Palestinians are still living their dream of returning to all their, the country, to have it theirs, returning what they call the refugees, although it's a second or third generation since they got out of the country. And the only means that we can solve this problem is make the Palestinians be aware that the dream is over. And the other nation that has always lived, by the way, for 3,000 years, there were Jews always in the land of Israel, that the other people living by the, next to them also has its right to its own one Jewish state, not binational or anything, Jewish state of its own.
Okay, I want to make sure we have a limited amount of time, and I want to make sure that we can get to the... I want to make sure we can focus on COVID for... We only have a few minutes left in this conversation, but can you explain more about this tension around the lockdown for ultra-Orthodox communities in Israel and COVID-19? Yes. Thank you.
Sure. So the point is that the ultra-Orthodox has always been suspicious toward the government because it's a secular government, secular institutions, Zionist institutions, as some of them regard it. And in the first wave, they're accused, and also for objective reasons, they don't have the means to, most of them are not are poor families, or at least not well off, with three rooms apartment and very large families. They don't really can distance themselves from one another, and a closure is almost impossible in the holiday season. So actually, it's very difficult for also, and not less important, the educational institutions are a very important part of their lives. It's very important religious value to study Torah, and an important community framework that you can't do without it, because if all the children are at home, it's really difficult to live. And one of the ways of to solve that is to send them to dormitories in the yeshivas. Now, the fact that the Haredim couldn't comply with the government instructions already in the first wave of became a reason for accusing them for increasing the rate of the dissemination of the virus and things like that. Some of it is indeed true, because for some reasons the Haredim are also, the ultra-Orthodox are also critical of the government. They didn't comply because they're skeptical of their reasons. It was also quite irritating to them that, for example, demonstrations and protests are allowed in masses often, while prayers are not allowed. So they, mockingly, they sent such a joke at the WhatsApp groups. We can make a demonstration called the Mincha prayer, Maariv prayer, the prayers of the day, and do that under the title of demonstration. The fact that demonstrations are allowed, other activities are allowed, prayers are not allowed, and their institutions are considered as sources of corona, makes them quite skeptical about that, and they fought against it.
I'm Jen White, and you're listening to 1A. We're talking to Benjamin Brown, professor of Jewish thought at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, and Daniel Estrin, NPR's national correspondent in Jerusalem. Daniel, explain a little bit more about how the Israeli government has been communicating about the coronavirus, the science and safety precautions overall.
Well, the Israeli government, in the first wave, took very stringent measures, a national lockdown, and made sure to communicate the safety guidelines in Yiddish, the language of a lot of ultra-Orthodox Jews, in Arabic for Palestinian Arab citizens of Israel, making it a national imperative. And there was initially some hesitation from the ultra-Orthodox community. I think today the majority is on board and sees this as a serious pandemic. Although today, I think the Israeli government has lost a lot of trust Israeli citizens have lost a lot of trust in their leadership when it comes to COVID. After the first wave being handled quite well, a lot of Israelis feel that the leadership has lost control. When this summer things opened up and infections were creeping up, the Prime Minister Netanyahu appeared to be focused on other things, on his corruption trial. He's facing serious charges of corruption, on a plan now shelved to annex occupied land in the West Bank. Yesterday, Israelis tuned into the White House ceremony on the South Lawn, and they saw lots of people without wearing masks, including some in the Israeli delegation. So I think the lockdown coming up on Friday, a lot of Israelis will be questioning the wisdom and asking themselves if they can get around it.
Professor Brown, very briefly, when we think about social distancing as being a tool to limit the spread of the virus, how does that impact how people are able to celebrate the High Holy Days?
Within the family, within the homes, there's no problem. Each family will celebrate it in its own home. Inviting people from the outside, including first-degree relatives, you know, parents, grandparents, second-degree, it will be difficult. Actually, it will be considered illegal, but many people are going to transgress it because actually it's something so rooted in Jewish tradition that you have all the family together for the Rosh Hashanah dinner that I believe many people will try to do all kinds of manipulations to overcome it.
Daniel, we've seen quite a bit here in the U.S. around COVID restrictions, this intersection of religion and politics. How is that playing out in Israel?
Well, as Professor Brown said, you know, the ultra-Orthodox Jewish population, it is about 10%, give or take, of the population, but it's a minority that acts like a majority. It has a lot of political power, crucial to Netanyahu's coalition, and they've been very influential in Israel's coronavirus policies. So, you know, these days, a lot of the ultra-Orthodox community feels that the lockdown is a kind of an affront to them personally during this most holy of times. Even one of the government ministers who's ultra-Orthodox resigned in protest of this upcoming lockdown. At first, actually, Israel was not planning on another nationwide lockdown. The plan was to identify cities with high infection rates and impose lockdowns just on those cities. But a lot of those cities are ultra-Orthodox because they're crowded, the big families living a communal kind of life. Ultra-Orthodox leaders did not like the idea of full lockdowns. And so now we're going to a national lockdown, and you really see the rifts of Israeli society kind of deepen, because a lot of secular Israelis say, they feel resentful. They say, why do we have to pay the price of ultra-Orthodox exceptions and the entire nation having to go under lockdown? Although the truth is that infections really are happening all across the country, not just in that community. But the pandemic is exacerbating rifts in Israeli society.
Very quickly, Dan, as you watch these stories continue to unfold, do you think it's likely we'll see new agreements between Israel and other Arab neighbors?
It's entirely likely. We saw Oman, the country of Oman, congratulate Bahrain for their deal with Israel. Oman perhaps could be next. The Prime Minister Netanyahu traveled to Oman last year. And yes, we could see more countries joining. We'll have to see.
That's Daniel Estrin, NPR's national correspondent in Jerusalem, and Benjamin Brown, professor of Jewish thought at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. He studies the varieties of Orthodox Judaism with an emphasis on ultra-Orthodox thought. Thanks to you both. Coming up, a big development on an important story much closer to home. We're off to Louisville, Kentucky to hear more about the latest in the Breonna Taylor case. I'm Jen White. This is 1A.